Thanks. So thanks a lot for allowing me to do this remote talk. It'll be okay. If there's a question, let me know. Okay, so I'll be, it's a pleasure to be remotely here. I'll be talking about unitary cosmological advances. And everything that you may like about this talk is thanks to Scott Melville, a student at Imperial. He's an amazing student. Yeah. And based on the paper here that just accepted. So let me start with some motivation. It's a very successful time for cosmology and general relativity, gravity. We can pat ourselves on the back with observations that tend towards the smallness of the cosmology. But of course, we're left with many still open questions from the very beginning of the universe. Even if inflation did happen to be the correct description for the early period of the universe, it's still just an effective description. We don't really know what the inflaton is, where it comes from, and any really consistent top-down approach for inflation. And then from maybe there's some alternatives to inflation, pre-Big Bang or other type of alternatives, which I think, of course, this workshop is centered on. So I'll be talking more about that, but to give some motivations as well from the type of effective field theories that have been considered recently in the past 20 years or so in the literature, there's, of course, in the later period of the universe, some open questions, the nature of dark energy, dark matter, and the associated cosmological constant problem, where I was, my original research has started from. But in describing different period of the universe, being the early period of the universe, pre-Big Bang, or the later period of the universe, all the way in between through structure formation, there's been a huge investment community in developing some field theories that can describe one period or another of the universe, or even maybe different ones. So it's a really non-exhaustive and I would say highly biased list of effective field theories that have been proposed in the literature. And this is, once again, highly biased. It's just the one I have come across in the past few years. Don't be offended if your favorite model is not there. But it's more to get to the point that we're not short of ideas, really, in cosmology, particularly for the late-time acceleration of the universe, into building up models or effective field descriptions that could explain some period of the universe. And so with this in mind, we may wonder how now it's possible to set some of these different effective field theory apart. We could just wait for observations to tell them apart. But sometimes these models have similar observation features, and sometimes observations are simply quite sparse or not strong enough to be able to set this effective field theory apart, particularly in cosmology. And they also have, within the low energy effective regime of validity, or if regime of validity, they even have some particular features. Most we wouldn't treat them as standard effective theories. We're kind of abusing their regime of validity, which may make us question the whole validity or the whole validity of the approach. And so to study this concretely and also as a tool to set different effective field theory apart, I will try to establish three different questions. And of course, you may have many different theoretical criteria that you may want to apply to these theories in order to segregate between them. But I'll choose some three main ones. And the main one I'll really focus on in this talk is the second one, but I'll give you some information for the first one and for the third one as well. The first one is, as I said, we typically abuse a little bit effective field theory language in using many of these theories. And so need to try to make sense or to establish whether this effective theory can make sense, even though we're actually using them beyond what would be the traditional regime of validity of this effective field theory, where the background could actually be strong coupled, even though the perturbations are weak coupled on top of that background. So I'll explain a little bit more what I mean by that. And then even if the first point is addressed, there's a lot of effective field theories which have been used for which you still need to check that the perturbations on top of this strongly coupled background really do preserve unitarity and derivative unitarity, so that they remain weakly coupled. And that's quite of non-trivial if we're dealing with an effective field theory on a non-trivial background, because your notion of a strong coupling or cutoff is background dependent. I'll talk a little bit more about that. And in the last few minutes I have in the talk, hopefully I'll give you some overview on some recent developments that they have been in trying to establish whether the effective field theory that I considered in cosmology, the list of ones that are established, could ever have a chance of admitting a standard Wilsonian EVM. And I'll go through the details of what I mean by a standard Wilsonian EV completion. If they don't, they may not necessarily be a disaster, but this is something that we may need to bear in mind when constructing these different stages of the universe. And of course, I have a motivation in cosmology in mind. Gravity is too hard for me. So I'll be really working throughout this talk. I'll really be working with the scalar field theory. I don't know if it's at the end. I don't know how well you can see the screen. I'll just be looking at an active field theory, and the motivation behind that is not looking at the full gravitational theory that we're really fundamentally interested in, is because we can look at a doubling limit where we send, for instance, Planck scale to infinity, we send some parameters to infinity in such a way that really the dominant physics of what's going on, of the questions that I'm trying to establish, is dominated by the scalar field type of interactions in terms of a particular background. And so we can take a priori decoupling limit where the gravitational theory with the matter sector looks like just some particular aspect of the matter sector to start with, and then at the end of the day, check this approximation, that this approximation makes sense. So a lot of the time when we're dealing with inflation, if we really wanted to have the power spectrum correctly and some of the details, this decoupling limit would be completely useless and wouldn't get the features as we know. But particularly when in the context of cosmological bounces that I'll be dealing with, if I want to have a regular cosmological bounce or if some period of dark energy type of expansion of the universe, this decoupling limit is actually quite appropriate, and so we can really focus on the phenomenology of some particular degree of freedom, and I'll just be dealing with a scalar degree of freedom without needing to be bogged down by the complications from gravity. So this is the limit I have in mind that I'll keep throughout this the rest of this talk. So this in mind, I'll be asking these three different questions. And then the first one is really to establish how much we can have these typical theories. And I'll use the Dirac-Born-Infeld, the Dirac-Born-Infeld example as a way to show what's going on. But that has been applied to many different types of effective field theories, particularly for P of X theories and for Galilei or Hendesky or these type of families that have been explored recently. So the Dirac-Born-Infeld it can be thought as the actor would come in from a probe brain within an extra dimension, and then that probe, the scalar field that comes in, the phi, would correspond to the, if you want, the motion of the brain within the extra dimension. And some motivations behind these two papers, in particular, a whole literature as well, that seem to suggest that this could be relatively well embedded within string theory, or at least corrections would remain under control. So as an effective field theory, as a low-energy effective field theory, if to consider such an action, such a Lagrangian, it really relies on the existence of irrelevant operators, and should also include all the higher-order derivative operators if we wanted to take this effective field theory seriously. Now, there's a particularly nice story with TBI, which is not always the case for any P of X theory, but X, I mean, the the gradients, the whole connection of the scalar field. This is my X when I talk about P of X theories. And I have a model, the Poincaré invariance from the five-dimensional symmetry, or even if it was ADS in five dimension, leads to a particular shift and DBI, relativistic symmetry, from the four-dimensional perspective, which means that many quantum corrections that you would expect to have from this DBI action actually present because it's protected by these both symmetries. And it's been shown that this model could be particularly relevant, for instance, inflation, where you could have a potential which may not satisfy the standard slow roll features, but still, because of the damping comes in from the kinetic terms in these fractions here, that could lead to a successful period of inflation without as much fine-tuning at the level of the potential I typically have. Now, from an effective field theory point of view, if you didn't know where it came from, and if you didn't know about the symmetry or any of that, you may wonder why you want to rely on irrelevant operators of this form without also being dominated by any other order derivative operator that would naturally come in this type of effective field theory. So in the case of DBI inflation, the answer is quite simple. It's because these people in the paper here actually checked the type of corrections that you have from the string-inspired model, and they see that all the other corrections are actually small. But really, what happens in this type of model more generically is that you can allow yourself to have field itself being not necessarily small, so long as the gradients themselves remain small. So it's kind of a reorganization of your effective field theory in the way you're counting your orders in operators. So it's not just dimensionality, the traditional dimensionality of an operator, but it's more the number of reciprocities by gradients. You can, in principle, trust all the operators that come to this package, and your field itself could be the gradients themselves could be important, so long as the acceleration would actually be small and under control. And then you can trust the background you're constructing your field theory about, even though it's abused the standard way you typically construct effective field theories. There's, of course, a little bit more to the story than that. You can actually look at quantum corrections that will arise in this type of effective field theory. You can compute the one-loop Poincaré-Weinberg effect action if you wanted to. And the fact that you have some type of shift symmetry in this model means that any type of quantum corrections that will come in will be suppressed by addition. Gradients, but additional derivatives. So long as you are within that regime, within that separation of scale between the field and the gradients, that allows you to keep background under controls that you have considered. There's a few caveats behind this type of assumption, but that's roughly the party line. And the reason why we allowing ourselves to consider effective field theories which go beyond the traditional regime, the traditional regime of ADT, and allowing ourselves for background configurations which rely on irrelevant operators without needing to worry too much about completely spoiling any of the predictions that we have. So that's the first step toward using this type of effective field theory to doing something slightly non-traditional in cosmology and trusting them on the traditional strong coupling within a traditional coupling regime. But when we go into that regime, even if the gradients are that are, we still need to check whether perturbations are indeed weakly coupled of that background. And that becomes particularly significant if we're dealing with non-trivial backgrounds, and particularly if the speed of sound is small, which is the case in many non-trivial scenarios that have been considered. And so to look at whether or not perturbative neutrality is preserved in this type of cosmological effective field theories, we can go back to our standard field theory course. And the one thing that we know is the optical theorem, or in other words, that the cross-section has to be PT effective for a given scattering process. But there's actually two sides of coins. So the optical theorem, really, I can think of it as relating the imaginary part of a given scattering amplitude. So this really is considering a scalar, well, a one-field model in flat space-time where I can define a scattering amplitude. But having done the decoupling limit in this case, we can do that. And by inserting a complete set, we can relate the imaginary part of the amplitude, and that includes everything, all the loops and anything that would go in at high energy well, with an intermediate process that we may expect to have. And that some positivity will have to be greater or equal than just the process itself squared. And so on one side, it gives us the optical as we know it, that the cross-section, which would be related to the imaginary part of the amplitude, this is expanded partial wave expansion, has to be positive, but also that the probability have to be less than 1. And so in this case, the amplitude of any scattering process of this form has to be less than of order 1. I put it as order 1 because factors of 2 pi is that come in, which would be relevant if we wanted to do it fully. So that's just if you have full Lorentz invariance, but if we're dealing with a non-background, a cosmological background, then the effective the Lorentz invariance is broken on that background. And what it means in terms of the field theory living on that background is we can have a non-trivial speed of sound. And taking that into consideration, if we just put that into the normalization of the field that comes in when computing this scattering amplitude, if we have an non-trivial speed of sound for this that just scalar field theory living on that background, then the optical theorem tells us really that the amplitude for our two-tone scattering process, and we can deal with it for any scattering amplitude a high order as well, for a 2-2 scattering amp process, it actually has smaller than the speed of sound to some power. And so that means that this becomes particularly difficult to achieve if we're dealing with models which have a small speed of sound. And one more intuitive way to see why having a small speed of sound could be potentially problematic is it's going back to the reason during inflation of why people were excited about having small speed of sound. In models of inflation, like in DBI inflation, P of X inflation, you actually have enhancement of Gaussianities in the case where speed of sound is small. And for the non-local non-Gaussianities, it was going for as 1 over CS squared, which means really, it means that the interaction becoming large when the speed of sound is small for the scalar field, that quantity here, and then that's why you have an enhancement beyond what you would not even expect in a standard canonical scalar field with a canonical gradient, with a canonical kinetic term. So the fact that non-Gaussianities are enhanced really means that all the interactions are enhanced, and as the speed of sound gets very small, you're actually going to get to be dominated by all the interactions rather than what you would have expected your background and your standard kinetic term to be. And that's what's going to start breaking perturbative unitarity. Once you start breaking perturbative unitarity, you can't compute anything anymore. You cannot trust your background, your cosmological background you started working with in the first place. It might be entirely unchanged once you were able to resum everything. So to see maybe that a little bit more concretely, or as an alternative way to see it, if I just think of a scalar field living on a given background, with a given speed of sound, CS here, I imagine I have an infinite set of interactions, some of which may or may not be relevant, and that doesn't matter too much. To go back to the roots and define my asymptotic states properly, what will come into computing my scattering amplitude, I can do a back of the envelope rescaling and rescale the space coordinates and rescale the field such that now my kinetic term is the standard Lorentz, what would be the Lorentz variant 1, like so. But now I put this rescale from the non-trivialities of map back into the interactions themselves. And we see that as the speed of sound goes to zero, some of these interactions start blowing up. The strong coupling scale as an energy scale, not as a momentum scale, but as an energy scale, the strong coupling scale associated with these interactions goes to zero. And so that means that there's a regime of validity of my effective field theory. And so no matter how weak my background was, I can never trust that background. The positions, interactions are going to just go out of control, and I can't compute anything. So I can't even trust that I entered that background regime in the first place. So that's potentially a problem for many models of inflation that we need to deal with more carefully. Although for many of the models of inflation, the speed of sound is never exactly zero. It actually gets very small, but it might not be crossing zero. But if we're dealing with cosmological sounds, that may become a little bit problematic. There's been some excitement into realizing some regular cosmological bounces in P of X my models. So once again, the X corresponds to my kinetic term. If I'm just dealing with a cosmological background, then it's just phi dot squared. And having a field model, GR, a standard scalar field, but with a non-standard kinetic term, so there's a function X that comes in, allows you to relate the non-energy condition in with some function of X, and it doesn't matter too much where the function of I is. Temporarily, it may not seem completely crazy, so it may not be so different to what was going on for DBI type of regression. So we see, of course, if we just have a standard canonical field, P of X is just, in this language, is just X, so P prime would be 1, and you don't violate the energy condition. But it's very simple to write any other Lagrangian for which you violate the energy condition, so long as you have a non-standard kinetic term. Now, the issue is that by doing so, you also change the speed of sound, simply because you're changing the gradient properties of your scalar field. And the violation of the null energy condition, entering the neck violating region, actually corresponds precisely in the type of model to bring through a regime where the speed of sound goes to zero. And so there's been a literature in establishing whether you can do that in a stable way or not, whether it means anything to have CF negative and for how long and everything. But actually, I would say the question is moot, because you can't even trust that you're entering a region close to CS is zero. You violate perturbative unitarity before you even enter the region where CS would like to reach zero. So you may go along here in the neck violating, you're not in the neck violating region, you're in the neck violating preserving region. And before you are even allowed to enter the neck violating region, you have to stop, and you can't trust your anything from what effective field theory gives you, because perturbative unitarity does break down. It doesn't necessarily mean that you need to consider physics beyond your effective field theory, but at the very least, you need to be able to resum all of these factors of interactions, which of course, it's very hard to do, but that would spoil any background predictions that you had in the first place. You cannot trust that you entered the neck violating region in the first place, and so even less that you had a cosmological bounce, a regular cosmological bounce. Okay, if that was the end of the story, that would be particularly depressing for P of X and my models, or just scalar models for cosmological bounces. But actually, if we're dealing with a standard effective field theory, as I mentioned before, you expect to have some irrelevant operators that will enter at high energy. And typically, we don't need to worry too much about them in the low energy approximation because they are irrelevant. But if it happens that some operators in the low energy effective description are zero, actually something which should be irrelevant could be important. And so just to give you an example, to be concrete, but it doesn't need to be realized quite in this way. If you thought, for instance, that coupled to this low energy P of X and phi theory, so phi is my low energy mode, also had a heavy mode, which I'll call chi, some given mass m. So the half of my low energy effective field theory, at least in a Lorentz invariant background, will be capital M. That's the mass at which the higher mode come in. I can describe my low energy effective field theory by integrating out that heavy mode, and that gives me an infinite series of free element operators, which are going to be suppressed by the mass of this heavy mode. So note that even though this looks like it has derivatives acting on my low energy mode, this doesn't suffer from any Ostrogat type of instabilities or anything like that, because as soon as you reach the scale, an energy scale M related to the mass of the heavy mode, I really need to go back to my original description and see that I did have a new degree of freedom that came there. But from a low energy effective perspective, I can just focus on this type of irrelevant operator as a way to mimic any high energy effect that came in from the UV, semi-UV complexion. And so in practice, I think of my low energy effective field theory. In this case, I just think of a P of X and phi, it doesn't matter too much. And then I have some higher order irrelevant operators that come in scale, which is related to the cutoff of my energy effective field theory. So here we have two scales that come in, really, this lambda scale, which is what we would have being this traditional strong coupling scale. And in a traditional field theory approach, we would think there's a Poissonian particle that comes in at that scale and to stop at that scale capital lambda. But now in a more loose approach of field theory that we use for cosmology, we allow ourselves lambda to be a strong coupling scale, but not necessarily any new physics needs to come in. So that scale lambda is by which the background becomes strongly coupled, but we can still trust what's going on at that scale because for the background of that scale, because effective field theory for the perturbations on top of that background can see a different strong coupling and therefore still remain weakly coupled on top of that strongly coupled background. But as you reach a scale as to capital M, then really new physics mean to describe the system, and so you can't trust anything that goes on as you reach that scale associated with the cutoff. So that's the distinction between the strong coupling scale and the cutoff of the low energy effective field theory. But now if I implement my low energy effective field theory with such type of operators, which is very traditional, a very traditional thing to do, then I'll have corrections, for instance, to the effective sound speed seen by the perturbations of the background. These corrections from relevant operators is expected to be irrelevant. However, it can be important compared to something which becomes very small, happens to be very small at a particular point in time in my cosmological evolution. And that's how the irrelevant operators in principle be important for these type of descriptions without going beyond the regime of validity of my effective field description. So as an infinite number of operators that come here, but I don't need to consider them, take into account. I'm still working in the low energy effective field theory. This is important compared to something which happens to be zero at some point. And so to work out and for this type of operators to save us from seeing perturbative unitarity in a cosmological bounds, you need to have a total trade-off between these higher order operators being sufficiently important to restore the problems associated with this going to zero, but still not important enough that start exciting them too much and you spoil and really go beyond the regime of validity. You need to look at all the other operators that would have come in there. So in principle, it's a subtle trade-off, yeah, but in practice, it could be possible if you tune things very very carefully. So this is, again, an example where the A and the B here is related to the speed of sound. So B of A would be the speed of sound square. And we have in mind for that particular model some which is close to what was going on for the cosmological P of X bounds. So if you have a small speed of sound, B is much smaller than this A here. This appears the coefficient of background dependent. So they are time dependent in this cosmological background. And so is the mass, you know, all of these different coefficients. So due to the existence of this additional irrelevant and operators, we have a modification of the dispersion relation. And when I ignore the mass, I'm working well within the WQ approximation. And so if this term wasn't there, we'll have the standard speed of sound squared. So the energy that is related to the gradient by C squared like so. But now, with these corrections coming in mind, we'll have some relativistic corrections suppressed by the effect of the effective field theory. And so when these two terms become comparable, the scale at which we have a transition between the relativistic and the non-relativistic regime. This is related to this coefficient and the effective, what would be the cutoff in the Lorentz invariant case. Now we have to be careful that associated with this dispersion relation, we also have a new mode that can be at high energy, which is actually the would-be ghost related higher order operators if the description hadn't broken down at that scale. And so from looking at the scale of this new mode, we can directly deduce the effective cutoff, at least an upper bound for the effective cutoff on top of the background for the Lorentz effective field theory. So, so depending on what A is on top of the background, you have a cutoff which is much smaller than what you would really had expected had you been in a Lorentz invariant background, for instance. So in terms of hierarchy of scale, we need to make sure that our background is itself it's going to be well within the regime where the before the transition between the relativistic and non-relativistic operators come in. And then itself to be well below the effective cut of the effective field theory. Now, if the irrelevant operators happen to come in at that scale, so if the slow coupling scale that you compute using these irrelevant operators happens to be below transition scale, then the irrelevant operators are effectively unimportant, and the strong coupling scale derived in the regime was the same as what before, which you knew was actually too large. The strong coupling scale was too small, was going to zero when the speed of sound was going to zero. So for these irrelevant operators to play a role and to save you from breaking perturbative unitarity, it's important that the associated strong coupling scale is a larger than the transition between the relativistic and the non-relativistic regime. So you need to have the associated strong coupling to be at least larger than that. And then you need, of course, the background much smaller than any of that. If you just look at a standard P of X and model, this actually strongly restricts the type of the size of the operators that you can have. So it happens if you just look at different scattering amplitudes. The amplitude which dominates the perturbative unitarity band is the one for the 2-2, is this quartic amplitude. And requiring to preserve perturbative unitarity, requiring that in the presence of the irrelevant operator, the strong coupling scale associated with this operator is larger than mu c and still within the cutoff, requires that the size of the operator. The size of the scale itself be large enough. So this is related to the size of the scale of the operator. Related to the speed of sound and related to the cutoff of your effective theory itself. So that offers, if the speed of sound is small in the first place, that you could have that the size of the size of your operators in your effective theory are themselves below the cutoff and still satisfy this type of bound. But it is the point I want to bring home is really that this is highly tuned. They require the speed of sound has to become very small, and you have to, your cutoff to be large enough, and then your low energy effective field theory has to sit on a sweet spot so as to be able to satisfy this type of condition and preserve perturbative unitarity. But that doesn't mean there's a no-go at all. It means that standard models of cosmological bounds, particularly in P of X models that we may consider for driving seller customer-critical balances actually typically violate this subtle type of balance that you would want to have to preserve perturbative unitarity. And in particular, if you consider any ghost content type of cosmological balance of this form, and then that would always violate this perturbative unitarity balance. So you need to consider something a little bit more subtle. You can consider, for instance, a P of X and phi theory. And if you look at something for the operators are all roughly natural, maybe I shouldn't go too much into the natural considerations here, but if I consider a rough effective field theory like so, where I only include in my low energy description one scale, lambda, and then all the other coefficients that come in at C here are of order one, and it just happens that at some point in my evolution, I'm going through a neck violating region, so B becomes zero, but at that point, all the other coefficients are naturally of order one. They could be a little larger, but not a naturally smaller reason or another. And the reason behind it is because you expect things to flow, the coefficients to flow into one another, so it would naturally be of order one. Then in this, you can see that if you look at the natural interactions that would come in, it would always violate perturbative unitarity. So if you consider a low energy effective field theory with just one scale, all the coefficients to be roughly of order one, there's no way out. In any of this of X and phi model, you would break perturbative unitarity if you want to have a cosmological balance, if you have to want to have be quite poor, which you need to have in this type of models to have a cosmological balance. And so to be able to preserve perturbative unitarity, really the model like condensate wouldn't work. You need something more than that. And a model which is roughly you put everything to be of order one wouldn't work either. So you really need to work very hard as a quite a high level of tuning involved to be able to have a cosmological balance in this type of P of X and phi series so as to preserve perturbative unitarities. But that's not a no-go in itself. So we looked at all the models we could look at in the literatures, then they would violate part of this perturbative unitarity bound. But you can actually, by sitting down and trying something which is contrived enough, just as a proof of principle, work out the explicit, very tuned, but still explicit P of X phi model. So this is just for concreteness what we looked at so that we could follow the cosmological bands that went through. The details in here don't matter at all. What matters is the fact that there's different scales involved. So there's, of course, there's a Planck scale, there's an effective cutoff that will come in, there's a scale lambda that will come in, there's some parameter Q here, which will happen to be extremely small. So there's some unnaturalness elements that have to come into the low energy effective field theory so as to make the condition work. But in doing so, a priori, there's no reason why having your low energy effective P of X and phi model implemented by natural correction or standard irrelevant operators that you expect to have in any effective field theory at some cutoff scale, you couldn't go through a simple cosmological balance which does preserve perturbative unitarity. So this is just a proof of principle as an example. Where in black here is the Hubble parameter. So we see that it goes from a contracting an expanding phase. You start violating the null energy condition here when it crosses zero. This, for concreteness, is just you have this sign. It is actually a little bit small here. The B and A coefficients, which are the coefficient of A is of the kinetic term, B of the grade terms, have a large hierarchy between the two. So in principle, that questions the validity of perturbative unitarity around that background. But take into account the high energy effects that you expect to have, that we put in at some scale lambda, which is large enough, we see that background and the mass of the scalar field on top of background are well below strong coupling scale. And this is the smallest strong coupling scale associated with all the different operators that we have in our effective fear theory. So we trust this cosmological background, and we can trust that the perturbations are within the regime of validity. So perturbative unitarity is preserved. This is not technically natural model. So you do expect to have some low the coefficients between one and two. So we're not addressing that question whatsoever. But as a proof of principle, we just say the coefficients are fixed to what it is they want, and I'm just going to construct my high energy conditions so that this is the case from a low energy effective field point of view. Then no necessarily issue with this type of cosmological bounds from this perspective. Okay, so that, I think that was the main message. Now I'll just, in the last few minutes that I have, I'll just mention something about the completion of this type of effective theory. And particularly with the notion that many of these effective field theories, which have non-standard kinetic terms and which have had some play some role for cosmology, may be unable to admit a standard Wilsonian UV completion. So there's, of course, some assumptions that goes in behind wanting to have a standard Wilsonian UV completion. But in all honesty, they're actually quite fair assumptions to have, or not entirely, not entirely, depending on the perspective. Some of you may disagree. But that goes for the assumptions that, that goes into that. But in order to be able to get some information within the low energy effective field theory from high energy completion, we'll be really relating scattering amplitudes, things that we can compute at low energy. And from analyticity condition, we can relate their properties to what happens at high energy, even though we don't have any insight on the particle content, on the field content that's going on at high energy. But just from quality considerations, we would expect to have the scattering amplitude to be analytic in the complex S-plane, S being center of mass energy, if we were dealing with Mandelstam variables to scattering amplitude. So just by looking at two scattering amplitude within my low energy effective theory, I know by the optical theorem that a cross section has to be positive. So that tells actually that in the forward limit, scattering angle is zero. So I just a direct scattering process like so. The imaginary part of the amplitude has to be positive. This is the case actually for scalar field theories. For more complicated theories, it's a little bit more complicated, but there's a direct analog to that. And then from an analyticity, which I'll argue comes from causality, and from a locality. So the big assumption here is locality, and there's a Lorentz invariance assumption that goes in. So locality and Lorentz invariant are important, but from these two assumptions, we can relate part of the amplitude, the second derivative of the amplitude, B is actually the amplitude where I subtracted some of the pole from the scattering amplitude, but I can compute those at tree level. They're under control. And we can directly determine that this quantity that we can compute at low energy is related to the imaginary part of the amplitude all the way up to high energy. Mu would be a placeholder for the energy quantity all the way up to infinity. And so without any requirement on exactly what is the UV completion of a low energy effective theory, just assuming that you have unitarity in the optical theorem holds, therefore the imaginary part is positive all the way up to infinity, we can directly infer that this quantity has to be positive at low energy. And that's the result by Adam Toll in 2006. So these results were known in the 60s, but the beauty of the argument Adam Toll in 2006 is really to relate information from the type of UV condition that you would want to have for your theory with conditions on low energy effective field theory. So if you put that in this type of P of X and phi model, just as an example, it expanded this in operators, and this bound is actually just for two to scattering amplitude. So if I'm just going to a tree level, I can just look at this quartic operator, and you see that the there's a whole story on why I want to stop at tree level in here. happy to talk about later. But this amplitude is related directly to that coefficient, and requiring this positivity bound in there directly implies that this coefficient C here has to be positive. It actually has to be positive definite if you're dealing with an interacting theory. So no P of X and phi model could ever admit a, what I would say, a standard analytic Wilsonian UV completion with the assumption of unitarity, locality, Lorentz invariance, and analyticity if that coefficient C is negative. This is an additional requirement you can impose in any field theory, in particular for any cosmological active field theory, if you further want to ask it to come from a standard UV completion. In a particular example that I mentioned earlier, with a particular cosmological band, we did actually check, and that wasn't our main concern, but we did actually check at the time, and the coefficient here is positive, so it does satisfy this positivity requirement. So as far as we know so far, the model I presented so far, the model I presented earlier, does not necessarily have any obstruction from having a standard Wilsonian UV completion. It doesn't mean that it could necessarily, would be able to admit one, but we don't see any obstruction so far. And that can be extended to many effective fields. So just to give you examples, this is how we can use some of the tools from particularly the requirement of unitarity and associated with analyticity, etc., to distinguish some of the effective field theories apart. And so, for instance, for DBI inflation or inflation, you could have you could preserve perturbative unitarity, and these models could have a standard UV completion, whereas for other models, some of these assumptions need to be violated. And of course, in this list, I wrote this, so its models have been roughly familiar with who I came across in the past few years, but a lot of them are associated with something related to Galileon. So the G here for G inflation stands for Galileon, and out of these effective field theories have in mind the existence of a Galilean with a, which is a particular scalar field operator, which is even less trivial than the X and phi. So the kinetic term is really non-trivial for these effective field theories. And so applying this the same type of positivity requirement for this type of effective field theories, we can see that within the region of parameter space, so G3 and G4 are just the coefficients of the different operators that you have for this type of massive Galilean, you can segregate a whole region of parameter space simply based on the existence or absence of a standard Wilsonian UV completion. And even though it's not a complete tension in between where you would want this effective field theory to be useful, and particularly where you would want a Einstein mechanism to work out, or some cosmological to work out, or these type of things, and this theory is admitting a standard Wilsonian UV completion, we see that the parameter space between the two, it does actually get more and more constrained. And we so this is for a particular type of positivity requirements from the existence of a standard analytic UV completion. You could imagine the region of parameter space which is allowed, and here could be further shrink down by imposing further considerations, which we haven't done so far. So I think I'll stop here. Just to summarize, considerations from unitarity, being perturbative unitarity or whole unitarity, can place strong constraints on different classes of models and effective field theories. In this talk, for concreteness and also for simplicity, I focused on mainly on effective field theories which can have cosmological factors involving some P of X, non-standard kinetic terms, but not too complicated ones, just a function of X rather than Galilean type of interactions. And we see that perturbative unitarity is actually always violated if you want to go through cosmological bounds, unless you involve higher order operators that would come in. And so you really need to impose the existence of a cutoff and look at some of the things that come in from your high energy considerations. But doing so, at least there seems to remain a window of opportunity where you could have, in principle, unitarily stable cosmological bounces, and these cosmological bounces may not even necessarily may potentially have a standard Wilsonian completion, or at least we see no reason so far why they shouldn't necessarily have one. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
Hope you can hear us okay. We have a few minutes for questions. Any questions? Robert?
Microphone.
Yes. Try to talk and then it should work hopefully.
So, do you hear me, Claudia?
I can, yes.
Okay, so can you say anything about bouncing models obtained via modifying gravity, for example, Hojava-Lifshitz?
Okay, so for Hojava-Lifshitz, it's even more subtle because you're really breaking Lorentz invariant from the beginning formulation, and I think you would agree that the UV condition is even Lorentz breaking. So definitely the third part of this talk definitely cannot say anything at all. For perturbative unitarity, I think you can start things there because you can amend the perturbative unitarity constraint, even if it's Lorentz breaking. So far, I think there's some subtleties associated with the additional degrees of freedom that comes into Hojava-Lifshitz to make it stable, right? So there was a story about the half degree of freedom, and you can make it as a constraint. So I think you will need to deal with that carefully during the bounds, which I don't know much how to do, before you can start implementing the reason for perturbative unitarity. But if you did, in principle, then you could go forward and try to apply these bounds as well.
To work like this, I think.
Okay. Can you hear, Claudia?
I can hear you.
All right. Thank you for the very nice talk. A question I wanted to ask is, some people have argued that the same constraints you are imposing of Lorentz invariance and perturbative unitarity lead more or less inevitably to string theory and lead to higher dimensions in particular. So do you have anything to say about that? I mean, do you think there is space for another theory other than string theory which satisfies those requirements?
So, actually, part of the locality requirements they are violated by and by string theory, but of course, in a way, it doesn't matter for this the way we use them. So I think so far we've been trying to remain quite agnostic. That there's it's really one way. If we find a theory for which any of these bounds were violated, then I would say that directly contradicts string theory. But there's no reason to believe this necessarily come from string theory. These are quite agnostic in concern.
So those people who have made this argument, have you identified the flaw in their argument? I'm thinking of Nima Akani Hamed, who has given many talks to this effect.
I think that's taking out of context. There's this assumption on analytics, there's assumptions on locality. These are not even gravitational theories. So I think it's really taking it outside the box. I think there's really extrapolation into saying that string theory is the only completion of gravity that we know of so far that satisfy these requirements.
That's certainly his claim.
Sorry, can you repeat?
Sorry?
That is certainly his claim, that if you impose perturbative unitarity and Lorentz invariance, you're led inevitably to string theory.
Yeah, I think I'll remain agnostic about that.
All right.
One more question, maybe? Should work like this, hopefully.
Hi, Claudia, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I noticed in your final slide you were crossing theories off, and you had a dotted line through superfluid dark matter. Mm-hmm. What did the dotted line mean?
The realization of fluid dark matter that I know does rely on some of these non-canonical scalar fields, which would be ruled out by these arguments. So it's in the realization of that that I know it would be ruled out. I think there's a grander story there, which I'm not saying anything about.
Okay, let's thank Claudia again.